You are now listening to Shh, Your Ancestors Are Speaking.
Thank you and welcome back to my podcast. I am your host, Smoothie Fox, and I have here with me Lori.
Hello.
World famous astrologer.
Right.
And we are discussing Hill House and the grief, the several aspects of grief in Hill House. I think where we left off, we were just talking about Stephen and Shirley. Mm-hmm. And now we're diving into the younger children, Theo. Yeah,
the other half.
Yes, the other half. So Theo, we believe, represents bargaining. Now, when I was deep diving on the internet.
Of course. As through, one does.
Yes. I think every project begins with a deep dive on the internet. I, of course, came through several Reddit threads that talked about how they did not think Theo was bargaining.
Interesting.
Yes, they did. They said that they felt she was more anger online. But I can recognize the bargaining, especially in the beginning when you realize Theo has a gift.
Yeah.
And she has a hard time. Well, she touches things and she can see right into whatever she's touching. And her mother hands her the gloves. Mm-hmm. So it was about accepting her gift on her terms. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And not being overwhelmed or bombarded by the feelings of others, which I think makes her a little bit cut off to people. If you look at the relationships that Theo has later on, especially with the last girl, she only wants her when she wants her.
Right.
You know, it's like she only wants the healing or the feeling of connection when she's ready for it. So I think that that's an aspect of bargaining. What do you think?
Yeah, I also kind of feel like bargaining is maybe the most difficult to understand. It is the most confusing, I guess, of the stages. And bargaining does have a lot of aspects of anger because you're moving out of the anger and into a new phase, right? So it is still kind of keeping a lot of that up. And I feel like you can make the same argument for Shirley then, that she had a lot of denial in her anger. So, yeah, but you know, you could also kind of switch them and, like, see that work for Shirley and Theo being kind of switched around, too. I could definitely see that. But the bargaining felt like it was really coming from her trying to gain control over the situations because she never really felt in control of anything, especially being the middle child. There's the oldest sister and youngest sister. There's the oldest brother and youngest brother. And then she is kind of quite literally that middle. In the middle of everything.
Yeah.
And it's very balanced other than her, so they're.
And let's talk more about that. I think that there's something to mention about middle child syndrome. And feeling that you don't get the attention of the youngest, but also feeling as if you don't. It's not like you're not seen as an adult yet, like the oldest child is.
Or the responsibilities that the oldest gets.
Yes. Yeah. So just not being heard, not misunderstood. Theo, she had this gift. And especially in her confrontation with Shirley, she's like, you all know that I have this gift. You all know why I don't like to be touched. But you hear Stephen talk negatively about it, about her not wanting to be touched. You hear Shirley talk about how she's cut off to people and you know, so it's just one of those things that she is just purely misunderstood, and that brings me back to the point where she tried to kiss Shirley's husband, and I think not only was she yearning for some feeling, but she was yearning for some type of understanding that no one truly understood how she felt or what she saw when she touched Janelle. Right. That she felt everything that Nell felt. Mm-hmm. And that if anybody had any true understanding of that grief, mm-hmm. it was Theo.
Right. And it shut her down.
It did.
It was too much to handle, and it fully shut her off from mm-hmm. basically feeling anything else.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said about Theo's, you know, just the way she felt misunderstood and mm-hmm. the way she handled everything. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like it's almost important to note that I felt like she was the most like the mother.
Yeah.
And or had the most like attributes that the mother had. And mm-hmm. so I always kind of wondered if there was a little bit of resentment from the father, or not resentment necessarily, but like him noticing these qualities in Theo and kind of turning away from her.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a lot of aspects. I've seen that, mm-hmm. in, especially in my own life. I think that when you represent a piece of something that someone has lost, mm-hmm. them not wanting to confront that loss mm-hmm. will mean them not wanting to confront you.
Sure.
And not wanting to look at you or see you, mm-hmm. Because you're a representation, you're a mirror image mm-hmm. of that loss, you know? So I can definitely see that.
Yeah.
I can, and that is also why the father, I believe, stayed away mm-hmm. and was not connected to the kids as he probably should have been.
Sure.
Because he was trying to protect them, but also I don't think he wanted to confront that stage of grief, these right. stages of grief.
Right.
I think his total avoidance of them mm-hmm. was him. And you have to think, he saw his wife still. He right. still communicated with his wife. His wife told him what ties to wear. And there's a part where she says, he was like, you were with me every day. And she was like, actually, that was an aspect of yourself.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was very interesting standpoint. Yeah. Moving to Luke, mm-hmm. Luke would have been depression. Mm-hmm. I honestly, between him and Nell, I think Luke was my favorite.
Okay.
I liked Luke because, especially in the beginning, mm-hmm. when he thought he was seeing a ghost and he was actually seeing the neighbor's child that right. no one thought existed.
Yeah.
Her name was Abigail, maybe?
Yeah.
And, but also him falling in love with the hat and then the man coming to get the hat
yeah.
and then the man representing, I believe, his addiction following him mm-hmm. and catching up to him because
right.
you know I think when it comes to an addict mm-hmm. that and it can manifest in so many different ways. It can manifest as addicting to drugs, alcohol, working, right. money. It isn't just drugs or alcohol. And I think that once you have these addictive qualities, they can, when you try to heal one, they manifest in another,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's always, once you're an addict, you're always an addict
mm-hmm.
and it kind of follows you no matter where you go.
Yeah.
And I think that he was a fair representation of that.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact in the beginning when he was in the treehouse and he was illustrating
yeah.
the monsters mm-hmm. that he was seeing.
Yeah.
I always tell people that naming the monster a lot of times will help you mm-hmm. conquer it. Like in the exorcism movies, right?
Sure.
They say, what is your name? Demon. You know, it's just like, that is, I think, a way of conquering it.
Sure.
So he was conquering these monsters in his life way before it manifested in illness.
Yeah.
In the addictive, you know, with drugs and different things like that. I think it's about how you always kind of fight these things, but in different way. I think that's why I really liked his character.
Yeah.
How did you feel about him?
Yeah. I did really like his character, but I also had moments where he kind of annoyed me the most almost.
Yeah.
because there were all these moments where everybody else was constantly trying to help him and save him.
Mm-hmm.
And he just didn't really have that regard for others. And he just continued to steal and continued to
mm-hmm.
Just kind of take advantage of all of the other siblings.
Yeah.
And there were moments where just, like, I felt like Nell was my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated watching her just be, like,
used
used
by Luke, yeah,
for sure. Mm-hmm. And the whole time it was just
She would, and she was the only one that believed him, too. Right. I think that the reason why he was a little butthole he was is because no one ever believed him.
For sure.
So this feeling that it has to feel terrible to sit. And I think this kind of shows in a lot of family dynamics where you have a person struggling with addiction. There are certain denials of things happening in households, whether it be some type of violence or something like that. And everyone in the house pretends like nothing is happening, and it is the black sheep of the family who is struggling because they are in the reality of it, and they're fighting themselves because everyone else is just pretending like nothing's happening, you know. So yeah, I think that I also really like the fact of him wanting to save someone else, you know, and then him seeing what it felt like when someone uses you, you know, and kind of cast your feelings and your thoughts to the side. I thought that was like a really cool, you know,
realization moment. Absolutely. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was really well done.
Yeah.
And, you know, the scenes where he just kept being caught stealing from his brother, or like, just constantly like using people to get his next fix, and then being kicked out of his rehab program and all of that stuff. Like, it, they did a really good job with the character development of somebody who has the so much of that weight.
Absolutely.
You know,
even at the end when he was doing the right thing and he stole his sister's credit card and he goes to burn down the house.
Right.
Even that, you know, the it was only then that the father was like, okay, let's sit in the car and let's talk, Steven. Let's talk about, you know, what really happened in the house and how this house is, you know, trying to kill us all. We're all an unfinished meal. That it was him making that dumb decision that made Steven have the conversation he needed to have with his father. Theo have the conversation she needed to have with Shirley. And it brought them all back home to the house, to really confront all of their demons. So I think it also, the Luke represents the character that is the villain, but the necessity of the villain. Because
somebody needs to be that.
Yes.
Somebody needs to poke the bear. Somebody has to...
So now to our favorite character, Nell. And when you, so the introduction of Nell is when she meets the bent neck lady. And we have had several channeling sessions when it comes to the bent neck lady and who she represented. If you want to kind of talk about that.
I mean, there's so much to say. About all of her. Nellie is such a brilliant character. Her episode was my favorite episode of anything ever. The reveal at the end of that, you know, the last 5-10 minutes of that episode was just so incredibly well done. And it did a really good job of showing that time isn't real. Nothing is linear. What is real, what is not, what exists, what doesn't. There's so many questions and things that are just kind of up in the air. And Nellie, you know, was haunted by this character her whole life, this bent neck lady, this entity that terrified her. But it was really her just seeing her own self, her own future. And it all kind of spun around. And, you know, when she does get taken by the house, which looks like a suicide, but it's not. So that's kind of a moment where you also learn, like, oh, maybe the mom didn't commit suicide either. And, you know, all of this was just one giant misunderstanding. And now here she is.
And trickery.
And trickery. And, you know, the games that your mind will play with you, and the things that you see, and all of it kind of pile into this one big reveal of like, okay, well, here it is. Here she is. She dies and she sees herself falling into these old places from the past in which she was haunted by
herself,
her own ghost, her own demons. Mm-hmm. And I've written a lot about this, and we've sat with it a lot. And when I was doing research for my book, we were diving into Hel.
Yes.
Or Hela, who is a character in Norse mythology who is half alive, half dead. She's a keeper of the underworld, very like Hades vibes in Greek mythology. And she has this same half-alive, half-dead duality that Nelly kind of had.
Represents.
And when we were channeling her, talking to her, trying to understand a little bit more of this story, the bent neck lady just kept coming up, this hanged man energy. And as a tarot studier, reader, enthusiast, if you
philosopher.
Will.
Philosopher,
yeah, whatever you want to call it. I have always kind of seen the hanged man as an aspect of Odin.
Yes.
Odin hanging himself upside down to...
for true knowledge.
For true knowledge, right? To get the knowledge of the world. That's where the runes came from. It's this, like... deep, deep knowing that comes from the hanged man's energy. And what came through when we were trying to, like, work with Hel was that this image of duality, of being hung, felt like it just connected right back to Nelly hanging over herself the first time she ever saw her. And that scream that they both screamed because neither of them knew or understood what exactly they were looking at. And the hanged man, going deeper into it, I've actually been really doing a deep dive into the history of tarot lately. I'm trying to put together a course of, like, the history of tarot throughout years and years and years, you know, going back to the 1400s. And the Hanged Man is one of those cards that's really changed a lot throughout history as well. There was a time where it was even called Prudence. There was a time where it was an image of somebody getting their head bashed in. There's all these different variations of it. And the Death card, which is the card that follows the Hanged Man, was actually not seen as death for a really long time. And something that I've been thinking a lot about lately is that death was actually called the nameless one. That's what it, like, translates into. It was kind of a nothingness. But people actually did used to fear the death card.
Yes.
And it wasn't until more modern interpretation that death actually became rebirth.
Yes.
And a positive card. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was more of like a, okay, well, what's the next phase? Whereas death actually used to be a card of bad omen, so much so that they didn't even put the word death to it.
No.
They just called it a nameless card and had this, like, grim reapery looking skeleton on it. And so...
And you feel this in a lot of readings, right? Anytime you put down that card, you feel them go, and you're like, well, hold on, right, before you start to read.
Well, and people who don't really know, you know, when you're giving readings to people who are unfamiliar with these divination systems and ancient whatever, you know, practices, a lot of people see death and they're like, oh, my God. And, you know, in Rider-Waite tradition, it's associated with Scorpio. It's associated with this rebirth energy, this, like, transformational change, letting go, right? But the Hanged Man, the card coming before it, is so much about sacrifice. There's a couple decks, ancient decks, where it was called self-sacrifice or sacrificial whatever, like, it's really, really changed a lot over time into this, like, letting go and this feeling of, like, true change and surrender. And so, like, when we were working with Hel or Hela, that was something that hit me super hard, was that, like, oh, the Hanged Man is actually the scary card, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually the card that represents that having to
give something up
or give something up, or like, you know, the journey of Inanna, where she had to let go of something in every
gate of hell,
every gate until she got to the bottom, you know, and she shows up completely naked and open and
showing that you have everything you need within you. And that all the things that we put on ourselves represent this facade of safety or, and if you think about it, as we, you know, that thing with Steve and the money and the thing with, you know, Shirley and her forever home and the business, it's this thing that we wear, these things that we think protect us when really the true thing about the hero's journey. Is the, you know, the trials, the tribulations, the ups, the downs, that I tell people all the time, if life was the way you thought it should be, it'd be the most boring movie.
And I always found it so fascinating too, like when I teach tarot or when I like really sit with the Fool's journey and like the journey through the major cards, the Tower comes fairly shortly after the death card. It's like 2-3 cards later. And after the Tower card, every single character in the cards are naked. And there's a little bit of like liberation that you can really see come through in those cards that just show this, like, I don't care anymore. Like, there's a true like freedom that comes with it, right? And the Star, which is actually my card of the day today, so that's great. She is the first time you see this. She's the card that follows the Tower. So she's the first time you really see this, like, naked woman who just doesn't care, has no cares in the world. She's unbothered. She's pouring her water around. She's trying to make sure everything's even. And she represents hope and renewal and faith. And the reason I'm, like, talking about so much of these tarot influences is to say that, like, Nelly really represented this, like, sacrificial Hanged Man energy that comes right before death. It comes right before this, like, moment of, oh, everything's actually okay, right? And it really felt like death isn't the scary part. The Hanged Man is.
It is.
Right? Yeah. The sacrifice, the having to let go, the getting rid of something that was important to you. Or
to welcome in the new.
Exactly.
And if you think about it, in the movie, she dies first. Well, after the mother. But, you know, as soon as you said that that's what's needed first, I was like, oh my goodness, she died first out of all the stages of grief. You know, so that.
But she finally made it to acceptance.
Yes.
And, you know, she's lived through all of the stages, so the acceptance is death.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is the final stage in that process. And so, and, you know, she kind of does die first because, like, the show kind of starts out after the mother's death.
You know?
It never really, like, goes through it, like, that's,
you don't find that out to the end.
Like, that kind of happened before the show starts, because the show literally starts, the opening scene is them piling into the car
and
to
running.
Leave the house, running away from the house that stole their mother, who is now dead. Right? So it's like that already kind of happens as like an opening, but Nelly was the first one to surrender to it and to join her mom and to be there in that space again. And, you know, there is a bit of a trickster type of energy.
Yes, I would say it's through the trickery, because she puts the rope on her neck because she believes she's putting on her necklace that her mother promised her. And, which, sidebar, why didn't Nelly get the necklace ever? You know, I always wondered that. You know what I mean? Like, you would think that Because they did go back to the house and get the mother's body, and there had to be, you know, because there was the scene where Shirley is having to see her mother. So I always wondered why that wasn't
why they didn't just give it to her.
Yeah, but it also makes sense because that would have been something she yearned, and that would have been the ability for the trickster energy, which brings me to the house and how the house became this place for spirits to stay, become trapped. Some wanting to be trapped, because if you think about it, the caretakers of the home, they there's a scene where the man is running his wife into the house to die in the house, so that way she can be there with the baby and the young girl. And you have all these ghosts, and but if you think about it, there is an aspect of that woman, I forget what her name is. She is the woman that came into the house that had the psychological issues, and she got with the man who also had the psychological issues. I can't remember the character's name, but she was the one that tricked the mother. She was the one that tricked Nellie, you know, and even when the mother was, she was told by the other ghosts, don't believe her.
Right.
She's the liar, you know, she's the one that you, because she didn't want to be alone, you know, so all of it was about keeping things frozen in time and not wanting to move on.
Right.
And that house was a symbol of keeping things frozen and not wanting to move on.
Right.
And even the father
standing still.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And even the father sacrificed himself to stay in one place so that way his children may be free. And I think that ultimate sacrifice that a lot of people make, you know, for true freedom, that was a part of it.
Right.
So how this house is like a time loop.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting that I just was watching a video a few days ago that was talking about yearning. Mm-hmm. So what you just said kind of triggered that thought. Mm-hmm. But it was talking about... it was a therapist tip, but it was talking about people who grew up feeling uncertain about where their love was coming from when they had parents who were a little unstable or, you know, they weren't giving them what they needed. Mm-hmm. They developed this unhealthy attachment to daydreaming and yearning. And so, like, how that can affect relationships as an adult is, like, constantly attracting yearning situations where you don't actually want the stability. You want to yearn for something that's ultimately never going to happen.
Yeah.
And so it did feel like... when I watched that video, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, shit. Like, that's crazy. Like, that's such an interesting, you know.
It is. Thing. And I think that it, in a way, we all will sit in a place of yearning. But I think it's also to avoid actually doing something about it.
For sure. And I think that's kind of where that necklace came in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nellie was just this six-year-old girl who, like, yearned for
her mother.
Mm-hmm. And her relationship with family before things got so crazy.
Yeah. And wanting to go back.
Right.
And if you think about the words, it said, come home. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you find out it said, welcome home. Mm-hmm. And how, like you said, time is not linear. It's mm-hmm. I think it was a fair representation of this theory. And I will talk about it in another podcast. It's called The Egg Theory.
Right.
And how everything is happening at the same time, all at once. So it seemed, when you're watching it from the viewer's perception, that it's going back. Back and forth,
right.
But really, it's a fair, true representation of realms and how we can be being in today, but then there is no today or yesterday or tomorrow. It's all at the same time.
And something I actually noticed the most recent time I watched it, or something I at least never thought about before in the other times I've watched it, was the scene where when Nellie is dropping into all the different places, she drops into the moment where her husband dies.
Yeah.
And before that, it shows the husband dying on the floor, her in bed watching it, and then the bent neck lady shows up. And so in her head, she was like, oh my God, this entity
caused it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that haunted me my whole life now killed my husband, mm-hmm. right? But then she learns that that entity was actually her.
Yes.
So maybe what the doctor said was real, right?
It was, yeah.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, it was one of those things where in those moments you kind of believe, like, oh no, like, no one believes her because she thinks that he was killed by the same entity that followed her from the house. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what I believed for a long time, yes. too, happened, was mm-hmm. like, oh my God, no one's believing Nelly, but... The doctors were right. He did just have an aneurysm, and that just was what it was.
Right.
But she, like, you know, it was just her visiting the most important moments of her life as she died. Like, it was her life flashing before her.
Yes.
And she was just able to see that. And right. so, like, you know, these moments where she drops off Luke, like, yes, she sees it again. Like, mm-hmm. this moment where her husband dies is a huge moment. Of course she would go back to revisit that. So mm-hmm. It just makes so much sense the more you think about it, because it's also not obvious.
Yes, it too. Isn't.
It's not at
all. I think it takes a very introspective person to, and after several times of watching it.
Right. Like, it was like my eighth time watching it that I was like, oh my God, wait a minute. Like, the house didn't kill the husband.
Yeah.
He just died, and she was going back to it.
Yeah.
And like...
Which brings us to the father, mm-hmm. you know, that ultimately the ending of the father was a representation of true sacrifice. Mm-hmm. He convinced the mother...
Yeah.
Who was a spirit, who was very much, her spirit was alive in the house, mm-hmm. to let go of her children. Because in her mind, the trickster mm-hmm. had convinced her that the dangers were in the outside world.
Right.
And that only by keeping them in the house were they going to be safe.
Right.
And the father... convince the mother mm-hmm. that we have to let them go to be free.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of connected to a lot of parents mm-hmm. and their fears and them right. wanting to keep their kids safe. But then you keep them in this perpetuated childhood mm-hmm. where they're not able to grow, and then they rebel. And then they go out to do things on their own. And right. because they weren't given this in a safe space, they can a lot of times hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's a true act of love about letting go. I think the way I compare it, and we've talked about this before, I don't have one particular belief system, but I think a way that a lot of people are able to relate it to is God's love. What is God's love, right? Mm-hmm. It's the ability that we can make our own choices.
Right.
So giving our children the ability to make their own choices, even if we might not agree with them, mm-hmm. I think a testament of true love is just providing a safe space for them
right.
and allowing them to make their own decisions. And ultimately, that's what happened with the father. He, you know, takes the pill. He overdoses, mm-hmm. you know, but we've talked about this, how mm-hmm. Stephen saw this, but says nothing. So now he's stepping into the father role of protecting the siblings because they're all trying to get Luke to the hospital and get him better. And then him and his father have that sit down powwow about the house now being to them, mm-hmm. you know, and, so I think that I've connected with that with my parents, you know. Sure. I think that for me, how I have confronted grief is, you know, I've lost my mother and I lost her at a very young age. And I went through all the stages. I think I was in complete denial, sure. of course. And then I went from denial to and denial shock. Mm-hmm. I think it was shock. And then, I have this point in my memory. I don't remember much about it because I just kind of, I think you close it out and you don't want to relive it. But there was this moment where I was at the funeral and everybody was talking about how funny my mother was. And my mom, while she was funny with other people, it was very serious when it came to me. And, like, it was a lot of, you know, rules, regulations. So that's kind of what I remember.
Sure, yeah.
So I remember snickering. Mm-hmm. While people were talking. And that's just in how much shock. It wasn't real, you know? Right. And it wasn't until I met certain points of my life where you need your mother, you know, right. like my first heartbreak, you know, these stones in the road that you meet where it's like, wow, I can't make that phone call. I think that's what kind of made it real
sure.
for me. But I think that the inability to face any of these steps, I can see it when with people I know are still dealing with my mother's death mm-hmm. because they're in this self-repair, like they're stuck in a part of the grieving process.
Yeah.
I think that that's a real thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of like what we were talking about with the house. It's a way that they don't have to confront it if they can stay in that space.
Yeah.
Which I don't know what hurts more.
Right.
You know, being frozen in that grief or confronting it. And I guess that's just a matter of perception.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What is your relationship?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's a little bit different mm-hmm. with that and how you handle or deal. There's definitely like a lot of moments, and everybody has some sort of something you're constantly dealing with
mm-hmm.
On some scale. And I'm not totally sure, I guess, what my personal relationship is. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it changes. It depends.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I love shows like this or like things that help get this conversation started so that you can start to notice these pieces in yourself
mm-hmm.
Or like different looking back on your life at different points that have happened to you and sitting with how did I handle that one
mm-hmm.
As opposed to like those things kind of becoming patterns, like relationship patterns especially, is kind of how things have manifested for me, and finding comfort in a lot of that grief
mm-hmm.
to the point of doing it over and over and over again, and just kind of like self perpetuating the cycle, I guess,
absolutely.
And like keeping yourself in those situations to a point where it feels weird when things are healthy or finding how that,
and forgiving yourself mm-hmm. if you are stuck
right.
in these points. When I first experienced grief in some sort of ways, in different ways, because I've gone through it in several points of my life,
sure.
there is this thing of relief
right.
and you feel guilty because it's relief, right? Whether that person broke your heart and they proved to be what you felt in your head and you're like, oh, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, for my instance, my mother was sick and then she was gone. So it was that relief of her not being sick anymore. And I think that, or being stuck in that place where you're not able to really confront that grief. I think that we also have to see ourselves with grace and forgive ourselves.
Sure.
For some of the points that we've had to stop at. And I believe it's all a part of the journey. This is how we heal. And this is how we get better.
Yeah.
You know, it's just accepting that
mm-hmm.
in ourself. And which is the final stage.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I've been on a huge tarot kick right now where we're teaching our Rider-Waite class. And I've been planning another like history class, and so I've been
class.
Thank you.
Shameless plug.
But I'm just saying, like, I've been on like such a huge tarot kick lately, and so like I've been really diving into the archetypes of the Fool's Journey and the Majors, but also like how the minors were drawn in. What those can represent too on the span of a journey. And in doing this deep dive, it's just been really like I've almost been relating everything to tarot
mm-hmm.
in a sense. So that's why I keep bringing it up, just to say that. But mm-hmm. the Five of Cups is the card of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I always saw it as like, you know, in the Four of Cups, you have these three cups right in front of you, and there's this image of a person who is just, like, arms crossed, like, looking at the three cups that you have so stubbornly, like, unwilling to change. Mm-hmm. And then there's an ace of cups, which aces represent, like, a new beginning, an opportunity. I always joke that aces to me are like portals. It's like, the portal is open. Are you going to jump through it or not? Right. Yes. And so there's this, like, ace that's floating above their head, but they are just still kind of like, nope, stuck. I'm here, I'm stuck, right? And fours can be a number of rest and reflection. And so there is this, like, reflective energy on, yeah, like, you know, it is okay to pause, but don't get stuck in that pause, or don't take too much time here. And then it transitions into the Five of Cups, where it's like the universe took out the three cups that were sitting there, mm-hmm, and knocked them over, mm-hmm, and replaced it with a two right behind you, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this image of this person dressed in all black. It looks like they're at a funeral or leaving a funeral. And there's two full cups behind you. And twos are kind of like a beginning of a journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if an ace is an opportunity, you don't necessarily have to take that opportunity. But a two means that you've chosen it, right? Mm-hmm. There is a bit of an aspect of choice in, mm-hmm, the twos that kind of represent, like, okay, you did choose it, you're on the journey, you know, what? You can change your mind, but you've started it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's almost like the Four and Five of Cups are actually, like, two of my favorite cards, and I, like, feel like I can always, when we teach it, I'm like, I want to spend 3 hours on just these cards alone.
Deep diving into it.
Yeah, because there's so much there. But this, just this image of, like, you're staring at these three cups that, you know, the universe knocked over and replaced it with two behind you. But my partner recently pointed out that if you look closely on the traditional Rider-Waite deck, one of the cups, water, the thing that is spilled, is a different color. And it's poison. And that was, like, an aspect of the card that I had never noticed before. And that's, mm-hmm, another thing I love about specifically the Rider-Waite deck, is that you can use these cards. I've been studying tarot for 10 years. You can do this for years and years and years.
And still
not notice these little details.
And still discover.
And right, mm-hmm, exactly. And, like, that, like, when he mentioned that, I was like, oh, my God, why have I never noticed that there's literally poison,
yeah,
in one of the cups? And so, you know, yes, two cups is less than three, or whatever, however, mm-hmm, you want to look at it. Yes, the universe knocked over the cups and you have to start over. Mm-hmm. But one of those cups was poisoning you.
Yeah.
And maybe the universe was saving you.
That's right.
From drinking the poison.
That's right.
You know, it's the same message overall, but there's such a blatant, like, look, there's poison there.
Yes.
Right?
So, and I think that's why you have to confront things with a certain amount of curiosity and childlike, mm-hmm, you know, way of looking at it. Because I think that's a big thing of discovery.
Totally.
Is that when you kind of get into the mundane of things, and I think this is with anybody at any job, you know, not even doing what we do. If you just know what you know and you're not open to learning something new, being stuck, right? You can miss out on so many things that can help you, and that can lead you into a different thought process, or maybe move you out of it. So I think keeping that innocent look into things and saying, okay, that wonder, never losing that part of yourself, you know, definitely being of the world, but never lose your imagination and your zest for learning. Mm-hmm. Being a forever student is so important on every step of the journey and every aspect of life.
And I think it's funny because I have a hard time being interested in things that don't have a lot of depth to it in general.
Yeah.
And so, like, astrology and tarot have, you know, they're, that's my job. That's, like, my loves. But what I love about Hill House and, you know, Mike Flanagan's shows in general are there's just as many layers to keep pulling back.
Yes.
I just think it's so funny because I have kind of had this association with the Five of Cups being the grief card, right? And mm-hmm. when I think of grief, that card is the first thing that kind of pops into my head. But noticing something in the card differently after staring at it for 10 years and mm-hmm. just having somebody be like, oh yeah, look, mm-hmm. like right there. Do you mm-hmm. notice the poison?
Yes.
And it was like, oh my God. And it was the same reaction that I recently had to watching Hill House again for like the 8th time and mm-hmm. noticing, you know, the husband didn't die at the hands of the bent neck lady. Like, it was natural causes, but she couldn't accept that.
Right.
And so, you know, there's so many layers to all of these things, however you want to look at it. And yeah, just the ability to be like, okay, you know what? Like, yes, I'm sad that this was taken away from me, but one of them was poison. Two of them were great, but like, it's okay to let go of the thing that was maybe slowly killing you to mm-hmm. turn around and
that's right.
see what else is there.
It's not about what's happening to you. It's how it's happening for you.
Exactly.
And I really believe that no matter what we go through, no matter the difficulty or the other end of the spectrum, the light of it, that everything happens for a reason. And I say this knowing how it sounds to those that are in certain places, and they think to themselves, this, well, what could be the reason for this horrible thing? But I think that time is able to give you a perception into things. It's just remembering that while you might not understand it now, mm-hmm. that maybe later on when you have a chance to sit with it and kind of think back at it, which brings me back to Nell and how she went through some of the key points of her life, like how we all replay certain parts of our life. But I think it should be from a matter of learning from them, not recycling and re-victimizing exactly. ourselves. Yeah. It should be a point of, okay, that's why that happened.
Yeah.
And that can give us better, greater understanding, and that will eventually, what this really is for and why I really started this channel, mm-hmm. It's all about healing. And I believe that literature, art, books mm-hmm. are all about looking at the human aspects.
Right.
And a lot of these movies mm-hmm. have the same theme, whether it's the fool's journey or the hero's journey, right?
Sure.
That you have the same steps. Right. And I think
the same archetypal patterns.
It is. And if we are able to see the symbolism of it, mm-hmm. then this can be a real place of healing.
Yeah.
And healing each other. So I thank you so much for coming on my podcast. Like I said, I know we have been talking about this quite a bit, and I hope to have you back to discuss another one of his films.
Oh yeah.
Because we have a couple favorites that we watch. Yes. So thank you guys so much for tuning into my podcast. Thank you guys so much for subscribing to the channel. If you guys have anything that you want to add, anything that we might have missed, please comment below so that way we may further the discussion if there's the interest.
I feel like there's still, we barely even scratched the surface of this show too. There's definitely like 4 more hours of this we could have done.
Yes, and usually when we talk it is
that much. Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much, and I will see you soon. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Shh, Your Ancestors Are Speaking. Subscribe to the channel and click the follow button. For updates on current events, follow Smoothie Fox on Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok.